You're listening to the Traveling Healer Podcast, where we bring to you inspiring practitioners, healers, and thought leaders from around the world. In this podcast, we smash through limitations and bring to you empowering information that can make a profound difference for your health and your life, creating a world of empowered people who know what is truly possible in healing. Hi everyone, welcome to the Traveling Healer Podcast. I'm with Dr. Rashid Bhattar today. I've been really excited to have you on the podcast for a long time. So I've actually hoped that I would get you on the interview for probably about 3 years now.
Really?
So, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Because came across your book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. This has been one of the best books I've read on health. And
you know, it's funny because I know you're not just blowing smoke up my rear end. I saw the little interview that you did on Instagram, and that's how
how we connected. I talked about it on Instagram. Right. So he actually saw my post on Instagram and actually liked my post, and that's how I actually got in contact with him. So synchronicities led to this. So it was awesome. And anyway, so Dr. Bhattar, he's the author of this book. He was on the Truth About Cancer documentary, which I had also seen a few years ago. And he's the founder of the Centers for Advanced Medicine. He specializes in chronic disease, treatment failures, difficult to diagnose conditions, cancer, autism, cardiovascular disease, neurodegenerative disease, environmental toxicity, heavy metal toxicity, chemical toxicity, and metabolism disorders. So quite a lot of things. And with some really great success, right? Yeah. I mean, success that I haven't seen anywhere else. So it's pretty awesome. His work is fueled by his vision to make the change the world is waiting for. So it's pretty inspiring mission you've got there.
Well, I think that's you know, if we're in service, if we can all be in service, it changes the resonance of the collective consciousness. It changes everything, really. And we shouldn't be in the state of health that we are right now on the planet.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I agree.
It's easily changeable just with the right mindset. And if we can change that, and it's not that hard to do. That's the funny part about it. It's just bringing a little bit more awareness and showing people that the possibilities that they thought was a fantasy is actually more like a probability. It's not, it's not just a possibility, but first you gotta get it in their head that it's a possibility, then make it become a probability, and then show them that it really can happen.
Yeah.
And
I mean, because growing up through the mainstream sort of approach to health, you know, I was always, I guess, I kind of had this thing that I thought that if whatever happened to me, I'd be fine. Doctors would look after me. I wouldn't have to worry, you know. And then I realized, actually, we do have control over our own health.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I was going through chiropractic college, and it just flipped my whole, you know, mindset. And actually, it was way more empowering as well.
Mm.
So to see people knowing that there is a possibility to get over, you know, things like cancer or things I think that, you know, just their genetics have caused.
Right.
That's what I really resonated with the work that you've done.
In fact, that's the reason we do some of those videos. I've even said it from stage. So do you think that I need another video? You know, it's like stroking my ego, or it's what are you doing for? The purpose is to shift that perception, shift that reality.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, person hears things, but they don't really experience it. They don't really feel it. They haven't really emotionalized it. Then when they see it, they see the person relating their story and what they actually went through. And now it becomes relatable, you know, because they had a parent, or they had an uncle or aunt, or they had a neighbor or a friend that went through cancer, or they've got a nephew or a niece that has autism, or a neighbor or friend whose child has autism. And now they can see the before and after, and now they can relate it. It's not just what they're hearing.
Yeah.
It's not even what they're seeing now, because they can see what they're observing and apply it to their own particular situation.
Yeah.
And that's what shifts the paradigm. That's
it
what
is.
Creates that. It's possible, you know, it's a miracle, to it's possible, to it's probable, to it's reality.
Exactly.
So it's a stepwise process.
So what do you think has been you've had such great success with cancer and autism and all these, you know, these cases. what would you say would be the biggest thing that you attribute to the success of, or the effectiveness of that?
Well, that's a two-part answer.
Yeah.
So for the people that would be didactic oriented, no understanding or awareness or belief in what we would call the esoteric, you know, the that would be the spiritual aspect, the mindset aspect.
Yeah.
If you're looking at that group, which by the way they're the lower evolved group. So we got two groups here, right? You've got the children, and then you've got the graduate students, right? So the children would be the ones that are didactically oriented, still involved with the hard sciences. Okay. And they're the types that would say that you cannot be a scientist and believe in God. Those would be that group.
Mm-hmm.
The group that says, I don't see how you can be a scientist and not believe in God, that's the evolved graduate level students, okay? So we'll talk about both those groups. So right. In this group,
yeah,
I would say the key to our success is detoxification.
Okay.
One word.
Yeah.
To the more evolved group, yep, I would say the key to our success, again, one word, I'm a simple-minded person, right? In general surgery, simple we're taught, good. When in doubt, cut it out, or heal with steel. So I'm very simple-minded. So in the lower group, one word would be detoxification. In the higher, more evolved group, I would say belief.
Hmm. Wow, that's cool. Yeah.
And so we are, of course, detoxifying, you know, regardless of which group a person falls into, we are detoxifying the person.
Yeah.
But I believe that that belief component is critical because the mind is the program that runs everything else.
Mm.
So if your mind doesn't believe that your body can get better, the body can't get better.
Yeah.
Your mind has to first believe that it's possible.
Yeah.
So as a man thinketh, that old book, you know, 150 years old or whatever it was, as a man thinketh, the author, Paul Allen, says, I hope that's right. If it's wrong, the name of the author, I'm sorry. But anyway, the name of the book is A Man Thinketh. And it's one of my favorite books, and I can't even remember the name of the author. That's sad, right? But anyway.
James Allen.
James Allen. Sorry, thank you. James Allen. Thank you very much, Nicole. Appreciate that. From the Peanut Gallery. Appreciate that. James Allen wrote As A Man Thinketh. And that premise that the mind, and there's a difference between the mind and the brain, by the way, so we have to understand that. But if the mind is the program that's running the hardware, and that program is flawed, no matter how good the hardware is, that computer won't run right.
Yeah,
right?
True, yeah.
And so one of the things he says, James Allen said, was the body is the slave of the mind. And if we understand that part, then we realize, we should realize, that all pathology starts in the mind. Right? And that's what I believe.
Awesome, yeah. And for the toxicity side, the detoxing, sorry, how does that work?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Say, there may be some diametrically opposed thought processes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So here's what my belief is. And when you look at pathology,
yeah,
let's look at cancer. I believe that there are certain people that cannot get cancer.
Okay.
Because of their belief system.
All right.
Because of their emotional state.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It has nothing to do with genetics. But when you've got a belief system and emotional state and all the other things, because you could have a genetic predisposition for the inability to excrete certain things. So you could have two people that have that. But one will end up getting cancer, the other one won't. And the one that won't, my belief is that certain people can't get cancer because they're energetic is something that's not conducive to cancer. Okay, so the detoxification, everybody's gonna benefit from.
Yeah,
everybody by definition will benefit from the physiological change.
Absolutely.
But let me back up and let me tell you how I came to this conclusion.
Yeah.
So reading things like Andrew Carnegie and Napoleon Hill when I was a kid, and my dad, you know, encouraging us to go through all these self-help books and what defines success versus failure, that type of thing, right?
Yep.
So go through that whole gamut through high school, college, then go through professional education. Then I'm treating patients, and I start having these situations where I've got stage 4 cancer patients with multi-organ system failure, multiple metastatic sites, referred to hospital, failed chemo, failed radiation, There's no hope for them. You know, they've been given 3 months left. They come to us, we start the treatment, and we've got them on video 3 months. We got them on video a year later. We got them on video 3 years later. We got them on video 6 years later. We got them on video 10 years later. And these poor people weren't supposed to live. And if you saw The Truth About Cancer last month, you probably remember that story about the young boy with osteosarcoma that I showed. I started the
I
whole...
I think I've seen a few. But
yeah. Well, we'll sure. I'll come back to that in a second because I think that's an important story.
Yeah.
And then you've got other patients that are stage 2B cancer. There's no metastatic disease, no organ failure. They should... You can't even tell they have cancer by looking at them.
Yeah.
And 2 years later, they're dead.
Yeah.
So what defines success versus failure? Why did this person with end-stage disease live way past what they thought, 5-10 years, versus the one that shouldn't have had any issue, same treatment. Why did they not succeed? So what defines success versus failure in cancer?
Yeah.
That's what I was after. And it took me a while, and then I started realizing that it actually, the same criteria that defines success versus failure in cancer, it's the same criteria that defines success versus failure in all chronic disease. And I'm a little slow. It took me a while to realize it's in all disease. And then a few more years, again, I said I'm slow, I was understated, I'm really slow. It took me even more years to realize that it actually defines success versus failure in all aspects of life. Cancer is just nothing more than the ultimate game and game over. So, you know, you don't start a business again. I mean, cancer, you got to next lifetime, better luck next time type of thing, right? If you don't get the wake-up call.
Yeah.
And that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
So it's the same criteria that defines success versus failure in cancer that defines success versus failure in education, in your personal life, in your business life, in your professional life, whatever the case may be. So,
and what is that?
Well, and that's what, actually we have a course called Build a Successful Life that we teach that, and that's part of our, that's part of the higher end group training. When I do the retreats, that's what we kind of go through.
Okay.
And a lot of that is belief, it's mindset, it's those type of things, right?
Yeah.
And of course, there's very tangible things from the health perspective, wellness perspective that a person needs to do, but it's actually applicable in all aspects of life. Because health is the one thing. If you have health, you have everything. If you don't have health, you know, you can have all the money in the world, you can have all the things, but if you don't have health, you're going to be dead. You can't take the money with you type of thing, right?
Exactly.
So it really defines all aspects of success versus failure. So I mentioned that young man that I told the story about The Truth About Cancer. So I didn't even know what I was going to say as far as how I was going to open my presentation. And I got a social media post screenshot sent to me by one of my staff that somebody had posted something on Facebook. And it was this young man, and he's sending me a message. Hey, Dr. Pattar, don't know if you remember me, but and goes through reminding me of who he was, and says, you know, I was the one that had one leg, I had osteosarcoma, you treated me, and I'm here today because, you know, of what things you did. And then last thing he says is, I'm 26 years old now, 26 years young now. And at the last part, he goes, in case you have a hard time remembering me, I'm probably the best looking kid you ever treated. Now, there's a reason he said that. That was so funny. Now, when I shared that story on Truth About Cancer, I explained this thing about belief. And the parents were moping around. This young man had osteosarcoma, and he was basically told that he had 6 months left to live, and they went ahead and amputated his leg to get the cancer to hopefully give him a longer possibility of living. And after they amputated his leg, they did a post-operative CT scan. They found that he already had metastasis in his lungs, so they took his leg for no reason. And so the parents were walking around like, you know, he's only got 6 months left to live. And so the first thing I told the parents was, look, you need to get your head out of your proverbial, I don't know, rear end. And, you know, I don't care what you believe. You walking around the way you are changing his belief system. He's a kid, so he doesn't know any different.
Exactly.
So what you need to do is now take stakes and drive them into the ground that he can latch onto. Right? And they didn't know what I was talking about. So I explained to them and I showed them. So I started asking this 12-year-old what kind of car he was going to drive, you know, what kind of car he was going to get when he got his license. And he would look at me like, I'm only 12. I don't even have a license yet. And I said, well, what kind of car are you going to get? You know, and have him start to get a mental framework for the future.
Yeah.
Right? One of the questions I asked him was who he was going to take out. Did he have a date to take to prom? And he thought, he looked at me like literally he was crazy, you know, like, yeah, I'm only 12, you know, prom's not until I'm 17. I said, dude, you're so ugly, you need to start looking for a date now, right? I mean, I told him that. So we had this, like, banter that we went back and forth. And it was, when I got that Facebook, I knew exactly who Tim was right away when I saw the thing, yeah. when I saw the post or the screenshot. But what really put a smile on my face was that he remembered that about, you know, so I said, I'm probably the best looking kid you've ever treated, because he was remembering what I had said back then.
Mm.
But what goes beyond what he knows or what I recognize, way, I mean, even though I pointed out, way beyond what we can recognize, is that stake that I drove in the ground for him, you know, about, mm. dude, you're so ugly, you need to start looking for a date. He remembered that, and that's the traction. Yeah. So how do you do that? You do that by fixating, like a mental stake, something mm. in the ground that you can hold on to, attraction. It could be whatever, right?
Mm.
If it's a woman with three kids and she wants to see those kids grow up and have children, and they're only 3, 4, and 7 years old and she's got cancer, okay, well, that vision is not that I want to see my kids grow up. That's great, but it needs to be more specific. I want to see my youngest daughter graduate from grad school, or I want to see my first grandson or mm. granddaughter, not even grandchild, you know, specifically, because you could have three granddaughters first and then may not get a grandson until the fourth child. Be very specific. The more specific the target is, the yeah. better it is. So it helps to visualize and create that type of a thing. In fact, this is part and parcel of, I just finished writing this particular chapter in the new book. Don't even know what it's going to be called yet. It's probably going to be something about cancer and conflict. But it's a okay. formula that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And the formula is the, well, I'm not going to give it away right now. I'd have to get the book for it. But the formula, I will tell you this. If a person uses a simple formula,
mm.
and it's very simple, if you use this before you eat, before you work out, before you write a book, before you see a patient, before you do anything, big goal, small goal, doesn't matter. If you just do this formula, it only takes maybe 15, 20 seconds to do it, I believe that a person can now alter the outcome and almost guarantee the desired result. Mm-hmm. Whether it's 3 months from now, 3 weeks from now, 3 days from now, 3 years from now, 30 years from now, I don't know, but you can pretty much alter the outcome. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer in that. That
Correct.
if you can picture it in your mind,
mm-hmm.
and this form is basically how to do this.
Yeah.
Awesome. Did I whet you enough, your appetite enough that you said you want this formula? That's what I was trying to do, right? Create that urgency. I don't want to give out the formula right now, Jamie. The only reason is because I haven't written it anywhere. You know, it has to be published. Once it's published, then anybody can have
it. They got to read it. You know, they got a reason to read it now.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. And it has been tried and tested for over 2 decades now.
Yeah.
So I just distilled it into a formula now that anybody can follow. But I realized that's how I was kind of achieving the things that I achieved. You know, when people say, like you talked about some of the results in these patients,
mm.
My friend, actually, my old partner, Dr. Victoria, actually, he's quoted in the book. He said something funny, and we ended up putting in the book. I think this kind of summarizes it. He called me the bumblebee of medicine. Did you remember reading that? I don't know.
I can't remember.
Well, we'll go on with it, and we'll see if I can remember if I can find it. But it was something I found it to be amusing, and it actually is how my mind works. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not in the book.
That's all good.
Here it is.
Oh, here you go.
Yeah. Buttar is the bumblebee of medicine. A bumblebee defies all known laws of aerodynamics. It is impossible for a bumblebee to fly. But the bumblebee doesn't know about the laws of aerodynamics, and it's too foolish to realize it's not supposed to be able to fly, so it just flies. And that's probably true. He said it a little bit different. He said, you're too stupid to know you can't do something. Do it.
You find a way to do stuff, right?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm interested in, because you started off with surgery, right, in the military?
Mm-hmm.
What was the turning point that made you decide just to go on this angle for health? You know, with, I guess...
I always wanted to be a surgeon, and I was doing my residency at Brooke Army Medical Center at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, which is where the Institute of Surgical Research is. It's one of the top surgical programs in the United States. And I took a leave of absence from the surgery residency to try to salvage my first marriage. And while I was the director of the emergency room at Moncrief Army Community Hospital, that's where my turning point was, and I actually write about that in the book, so you probably remember the story. Yeah.
Mm.
So I won't bore people with the details. You can read the book if you want. But basically, that was my turning point. There were multiple turning points, but that was probably the very first big turning point where I started to kind of question, you know, maybe we need to look at things differently.
Yeah.
But I always did things differently anyway. I didn't, you know, I would always question,
yeah,
why are we doing this? Why are we giving this fluid to this patient that's post-trauma? Why aren't we doing that, you know?
Yeah.
And it got me into a lot of hot water because you're not supposed to ask. You're just supposed to execute. And
that's the same with me. I've always had questions in the back of my mind, like, you know, what, you know, there's got to be something better, something that makes, you know, more sense, you know, and that's what put me on this path as well, of actually figuring out why we like the way we are and what's actually causing it, rather than working on symptoms and masking the symptoms. And so, yeah, I've been really curious, you know, in particular about cancer for a long time, for that reason.
Symptoms, so, to focus in on the symptoms, that's not a problem.
Yeah.
It's that you can't treat the symptoms, because the symptoms are a feedback of the body telling us whether we're on the right track or the wrong track.
Exactly.
So I look at symptoms, but I'm not addressing the symptoms. I'm just addressing the underlying causation. And if I'm addressing it appropriately and effectively, then those symptoms should disappear. And that gives me feedback that, okay, I'm addressing it correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that in all different specialties of medicine, the only type of doctor that really truly understands that are surgeons, because a surgeon doesn't want to treat with pain medication, because if it's a acceleration decelerating injury, or say, you know, penetrating trauma, and you give somebody pain medication, you don't know if they're deteriorating or not, so you have to observe the patient. And if you end up giving pain medication, you can alter their sensorium, and they don't have any pain, so they can't tell you. So the observation right after that acceleration deceleration injury, you have to observe the patient and see, is their belly getting swollen or not getting swollen? Are they complaining of abdominal pain or not? And if you cover it up with a pain medication, then you've obtunded the patient, so now the patient can't give you any feedback. But most doctors are treating patients palliatively, you know what I mean? And so a lot of the body work type physicians, like chiropractors, people that are doing Reiki and stuff, they look at where the symptom is, but they know that they don't necessarily have to treat that problem. There's an underlying issue causing that problem, right?
Yeah.
Sure, some chiropractors may articulate that area, but they understand that there's a muscle contractor somewhere that's causing articulation to now be necessary to take place, right?
Yeah.
So it's a cause and effect type thing.
In
allopathic medicine, I think that's where the biggest problem is, that they immediately go for covering up the symptom.
Yeah.
It's immediate alleviation of the problem, and they get this false sense of security that, okay, the flashing light on the dashboard of my car is no longer flashing, so the engine's fine. And we know that's not how it works.
Out of sight, out of mind, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
So I noticed in your book, and you talk about it a lot, is you know, the hope, you know, hope of the client, which I guess goes into the beliefs, right? So if someone's got a label, a diagnosis, and, you know, their doctor said, oh, well, you know, once you've got that label, that pretty much means, you know, you fit into this category, and maybe you live this long, or there's nothing you can do about it. What I find, I guess, a little bit frustrating is that if they actually believe what that person recommends, it limits what is possible. So I like to open up the possibilities more, you know.
Absolutely.
Give more options, and even if they don't know the answer now, keep looking, you know, because I believe that there is always something out there that can help you, rather than...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that in many religions, I know that in Islam it's believed this, and there are certain other religions that I think... I studied theology in college, but in a lot of the monotheistic religions anyway, and in some of the Far Eastern religions, a lot of native traditions also believe the same thing, that all solutions are possible. There's a solution for every problem. So in Islam, the thing is, they said that the Prophet Muhammad said that there is no disease on earth where the solution for that disease is also not present. And so you can, in fact, the more I think about this, I'm sure even all the native traditions, I know that in the Native American traditions, there's that same type of belief, right? That Mother Earth is going to provide for whatever the problem is. So if we start with that premise, then you're absolutely right that when a professional tells you that there's no hope, they've just basically passed a death sentence on the individual, right?
Yeah.
This actually reminds me of something that happened when I was a surgery resident. My biggest pet peeve is when people would ask me, Doc, how much time do I have left? Right? And you actually hear that all the time as a medical student, as a resident, and in private practice, I think that's like the most ludicrous question. And I would tell my, when I was in private practice, I would tell patients, like, why are you asking me how much time, what do I look like? Do I look like I've got a crystal ball? You know? How much time do you think you have? Because whatever time you think you have, that's what you've got left.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But they're so used to the doctor saying, yeah, you've got 3 to 6 months left to live, or you've got, you know, 9 months left to live.
Yeah.
So as soon as a doctor says that, if you hear a doctor saying that, you need to turn around, you need to run away from that doctor as fast as you can. Because I can tell you this. In 1999 and in 2001, I had two cancer patients that passed where the families agreed to an autopsy. Now, I had asked patients before, but when a patient dies and they have cancer, the family doesn't want to spend more money because they say, well, we know what they died of. They died of cancer. So I don't want to spend another $4,000 or $5,000 to go and get an autopsy done. But in 1999, I had a family that agreed. And I had a second family in 2001 that agreed. What was interesting was both patients that died of cancer on autopsy, guess what they found?
Not cancer.
A lot of interesting things, but no cancer. Okay?
Yeah.
And they both died plus or minus 2 weeks from when the oncologist predicted that they were going to die.
Wow.
Now, the second patient had hepatocellular carcinoma. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine, Dr. Quillen. And what was interesting is that he had hepatocellular carcinoma. And he came into the clinic basically obtunded. He was already in his late 70s. He was not even responsive, you know, had the O sign, mouth open, glassy eyes, in a wheelchair. And I even thought to myself, why are they even worried about this man with liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma? Because, I mean, he's lived a good life. And the son was an Air Force pilot and was very adamant. His dad had been a very big influence in his life. He just was very adamant that he wanted to do whatever could be done. And so, you know, I said, we'll try. And within about 4 weeks, he was walking to the clinic. And in 8 weeks, he was feeling so good, he had to go back to Detroit. He hadn't finished his treatment. But he said he had to go back to Detroit because he had rental properties that rent hadn't been collected. And, I mean, this guy wasn't even aware of who he was 8 weeks earlier. But he was adamant about it.
Yeah.
Now, what was interesting was he did pass about 9 months later. He never came back to the clinic. It was one of those situations that when a person wins a battle, they think they won the war, and you have to tell them that you haven't won the war, you just won a battle. It's great, but they feel so good that they don't think they need any more treatment. And this guy actually went, and he was planning coming back, and for whatever reason didn't. And so he died about 9 months later. So after he passed, the son, his nephew owned a funeral home. And the funeral home is, the body was transferred to the funeral home, but that's when the family made the decision to do the to get the autopsy done. So they had to transfer the body from the funeral home to the morgue for the autopsy. And the nephew who owned the funeral home came to me a couple months after he died and said, Dr. Buttar, I want to tell you this story that happened because I think it's important for you to know. So what happened was that the pathologist contacted the funeral home and said, you sent me the wrong patient. The funeral home said, no, we sent you the right patient. And went back and forth a couple of times. And finally, the funeral home said, look, we had four patients that came through our facility this week. That passed, that were going to be, you know, came to our funeral home. Three of them were women. One was a male. We know the difference between a man and a woman. You got the right patient.
Yeah.
It's the only male that came through our facility. And the pathologist's report basically was, not only did this guy not have cancer, or hepatocellular, he didn't have any trace of cancer.
Wow.
He had a liver of a 30-year-old.
Wow.
So that's what the treatment had been able to do. But his belief...
That's so fascinating.
Yeah, so his belief system, though, he had cancer, and then people telling him, you know, he was gung-ho, he was ready to go, and he went. But now what happened after that eight-week point when he was feeling so good, and he goes back to Detroit? Now the people are saying, oh, wait a second, is this the guy that had the liver cancer? You have liver cancer. You didn't have chemo? You didn't have radiation? Whatever it was, I wasn't there, so I don't know what went through his head. But that belief system, what he experienced was altered over time, and maybe he started believing it, or he, you know, the mindset that dealt that created the cancer in the first place hadn't been negated. Mm. So this brings up a very important point about the emotional toxicity, which is the fifth toxicity, is that emotional psychological aspect has not been adequately addressed. The underlying pathology will always recur.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes. Wow. Wow, okay. There's a lot of things I could talk about here. So you've actually, I see you do a lot on vaccines as well, so like detoxing the body from vaccines. So what exactly are you detoxing with vaccines, I guess? And
well, I don't really do too much detoxifying from vaccines. I'm a proponent of, if you're going to vaccinate, to do it smart. Don't do it stupidly as it's done. Use single-dose vials. Do it at the age of 3 or later.
Mm.
Space it out, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, it's still introducing a poison. Mm. But if you have somebody that needs detoxification, there's no difference between our detoxification process for heavy metals versus vaccines. It's the same thing. We're just dealing with heavy metal issue.
Nice. Heavy metals being...
primarily mercury, but the lead and aluminum and nickel and tin and arsenic and all that stuff, antimony.
Would that be one of the main causes, do you think, the heavy metals?
Of
cancer or...
Well, it's one of the seven toxicities, so yes, it contributes, but there's no single causation,
true,
right?
True.
So you've got, in the book, you probably remember the seven toxicities.
Yes.
So the first one, that's probably what you're setting me up for. You want me to talk about that? Okay, so the seven toxicities, one, heavy metals, two, persistent organic pollutants, that's the... chemicals, the insecticides, the pesticides, the formulated hydrocarbons, the organophosphates, all those type of things. The third one is opportunistics. Opportunistics meaning something that needs an opportunity to set up house in your body.
Mm.
So if you look at the first one, heavy metals, and second one, persistent organic pollutants, they both will cause an immunosuppression. They'll cause the immune system to be suppressed.
Yep.
And then that will allow the opportunistic now to have an opportunity to set up house. That's the bacteria, the viruses, the spirochetes, mycoplasma, yeast, fungus, parasites, whatever. That's all those opportunistic type things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the third toxicity. Beyond these first three are tangible. You can measure them. You know,
they're not so
out there. But the next four are somewhat, people could say they're out there. They're more esoteric. So fourth one is energetics. A little bit harder to measure, but everything from the electromagnetic radiation, ambient cell phone radiation, microwave, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
The fifth one is what we were talking about. I don't think any of these are more important than the others, but if there was going to be one more important than the other one, I would say it's the fifth one, which is the fifth toxicity, the emotional psychological aspect. And that's where these emotional traumas come in, memories, whatever the person's had issues with, things that eat away slowly at you, they form an abscess and, you know, eat away and rot away inside you until they finally manifest as cancer or heart disease, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
The emotions has a huge, huge role in pathology. The sixth one is foods, and it's not what we're eating, but what we're doing to the foods. So that's the pasteurization, homogenization, irradiation, genetic modification, all the different things, how we alter food.
Mm.
And then the seventh one is spiritual toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
And spiritual toxicity is a pretty big one, believe it or not. I used to actually have a package together with the emotional psychological one, but we changed it and separated it because there's a lot of evidence that some people that have emotional psychological toxicity don't have a spiritual toxicity and vice versa. Some people that have a spiritual toxicity don't have an emotional psychological one.
Yeah.
But the summary of a spiritual toxicity component would be where one person feels that it's their obligation or their right to alter the belief system of someone else.
Okay.
So I would say that oncologists, in my book, most oncologists, the majority, 99.9%, have a spiritual toxicity.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because they're, I think that inherently they may or may not, I don't know what they believe themselves, but they're taking their belief system and imposing it on a cancer patient that that's the only thing that they can do. Now, I have a couple of oncologists that are very close friends of mine. They came through my training program, and there may be some oncologists out there that would be offended by what I said, but if you talk to most oncologists, here's how you can tell if an oncologist or any doctor for that matter has a spiritual toxicity. If you see the doctor and they're happy, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a spiritual toxicity. If they're walking around, you know, constantly in a state of depression, they have a spiritual toxicity. They know what they're doing is inherently in conflict with what their belief system is. I mean, I've had this happen at least half a dozen times, you know, flying in a plane at a conference, whatever, and, you know, talking. I had this situation actually flying from Tennessee to North Carolina after a conference, and I was sitting next to this guy, and he was a politician, actually, and we talked for a while, and then he says, what do you do? And I said, I'm a doctor. And he was shocked. And you know, I was a little amazed. He goes, one of my brothers is a doctor, and he goes, all my neighbors are doctors. You know, my three closest friends are doctors, and so he goes, but you don't come across as a doctor. And I was like, why? And he goes, because you're happy. He goes, they're all miserable. So I think that's probably a good way of seeing whether a person has a spiritual toxicity or not, is whether they're happy. And that doesn't mean that bad things haven't happened to you or difficult things, you know, obstacles haven't arisen in your life. It's just, how do you deal with that? How do you look at it? A person, I think, that's spiritually toxic is going to see it as a victim mentality, and or they're going to be in a, because they're not living their truth, they're going to be in a state of chronic depression or... I think people that are anxious, for example, right? There's some imbalance there, whether it's a past trauma that's causing it, or whether it's a memory, a suppressed memory, or so. There's all these aspects. So fifth and yes, it's possible that a person can have a fifth and a seventh toxicity: emotional, psychological, and a spiritual toxicity. But I find more often it's one or the other.
Yeah,
it's possible to have them both, but there are people that have a spiritual toxicity. Do you know that there are more people that have died in the name of God than any other cause of death put together? Diseases, wars, everything. More people have died in the name of God. Yeah. So, you know, I like to say, I don't know what your God believes, what your belief in God is, or what your God believes, but my God believes in love and acceptance, not in, if you're not going to do this, you're going to die. And I'm going to make sure I'm going to kill you now to make sure. You know, so there's more people that are killed all the time. If you look at it, even the religious dichotomies that people have to deal with all the time, you know, you've got Muslims against Jews, Jews against Christians, Christians against Muslims, I mean, whatever it is. If that's not enough, then you've got, within the Islam, you've got Sunnis against Shiites. Within Christianity, you have Catholics against Protestants. You've got, you know, you've got all these denominations. And if that's not enough, then you've got the various sects within the church. But then, the church down the street from this church, even though they're both Methodist churches, have got issues between themselves. So it's man that creates the problem, right? It's not the belief is very simple, that there's a supreme being, whatever that being is, and whatever you choose to call that being, whatever the label is, source, energy, universal consciousness, you know, God, whatever, it doesn't make any difference. It's, everybody has a belief, and if I respect your belief and you respect my belief, no matter how different it is, then you don't have a spiritual toxicity. If you can't respect somebody else's belief system, then you have a spiritual toxicity.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Got a question here. What's your number one health advice for the average person out there if they're wanting to live longer, prevent disease?
Would you think that would be a hard question for me to answer?
Yeah, I do.
It's actually so easy.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, instantly.
I mean, after you've gone through all that.
it's actually in the book. It's actually one of the steps in the book. And I would have, the hard part for me would be to decide which one.
Yeah.
There's two of them that would fall into that, the number one most important thing.
Mm.
So, one would be water consumption, hydration, okay? The other one would be exercise. It's one or the other. And I would say exercise is probably the most important. But having said that, hydration is very important too, because we're in chronic dehydration. So, it would be a tie between the two. Hydrate and exercise. If you want to, you know, really live a longer, better, healthier life, just do those two things. You're going to see a difference.
What's your view on water? So, like, you know, town water supplies got chlorine and fluoride and all sorts of things. What do you think is the best water we can get?
Well, there are a lot of products out there that you can get, a lot of different water filters, and we've looked at a lot of different ones, and if you are familiar with Omoto's work, where they change the structure of water by with emotions, right? So I think to bless your water, have a container that says love and gratitude on it, have the water in there, whether it's reverse osmosis, it's distilled, whatever, you know, clean source, try to stay away from tap water,
because
the chlorine and the fluoride, but you know, take it through just any kind of filtration device, because I've now believed that intention is the most important thing, and if you could put that intention of love and gratitude to the water, of course we have the bands that you wear, that I wear, those bands will change the configuration of water to a certain extent, and water and exercise, simple.
Right. I think we've gone over most things, and I reckon if anyone wants to learn some more about how to be healthier, how to live longer, I mean, first of all, read this book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. But how else can people I guess, reap the benefits of what you're doing.
I would recommend people go to advancedmedicine.com.
Yep.
It's you can't get in there unless you have an invitation.
Okay.
An invitation code, and yep, you could give them your invitation code if you have it, if you decide you want your listeners to go there. And go there and take the HeadMap. A HeadMap stands for the Advanced Health Evaluation and Assessment for Detoxification, the medical assessment program. And it gives you an idea of where the burden in your body is as far as the organs of detoxification. And then there's specific protocols you can, if you decide you want to partake in those, we recommend certain things. Or if you don't want to and you want to do whatever you're doing, that's fine too. But it's a good way to get an understanding of where your body is. And the HeadMap is unique in the sense, besides the fact that it's free and you can use it anytime you want, it is a tool that allows you to do two things. One, determine how effective your treatment is, whatever that treatment is, whether it's, you know, some type of pharmaceutical or standing on your head and chanting a mantra, whatever it is, it'll allow you to know whether it's effective or not.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because as the score drops, and you know you're getting better.
Yeah.
And the second thing is it allows you to track your progress, whether you're getting better or worse.
Yeah. So. Yeah. This the HeadMap questionnaire is really very thorough. And how long does it take? About an hour?
45 minutes.
45
yeah.
minutes. Yeah. That's it's really good. So.
And the questions are actually, they're all symptomatic based questions, but what's interesting is the process that we've taken through. There's almost 60 million calculations done to determine what is wrong with the person. And this isn't something that I just came up with, a harebrained scheme. This is actually how I built my practice up from, you know, the first version of the HeadMap was in 2000, and we went to an electronic version in 2008, and it's gone through over 100 revisions electronically. And this is how I built my practice, where we've never advertised and have patients now from, you know, 90 different countries. So the HeadMap is the tool that I use in my practice, and I will not see a patient unless they've done the HeadMap, because on one page I can tell exactly what that patient is and see their entire history, whether they came to me 20 years ago or last week. I know exactly on one page where they are and what their state of health is. They can't lie to me. It's always there. People have even tried to, like, you know, sugarcoat things, but I know right away. And it's almost like a crystal ball. It tells you exactly what you need to do. That's what it is.
Great. Yeah, awesome. Also, your social media.
Do you have an invitation code for...
I've got an advancedmedicine.com invitation code. It is 19566. So,
because I'm sure that if you have people listening to it, they're going, well, what's the...
I'll write underneath the... I'll put it on the video.
Okay,
as well,
unless you didn't want to invite them. I don't know.
No,
it's, okay.
It's all good. No.
Yeah. So. For the social media part, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. So it's just YouTube at drbitar.com or youtube.com. /Dr. Bitar. Instagram is same thing, Dr. Bitar. D-R-B-U-T-T-A-R. So.
Awesome. All right. Is there anything else you want to share or with the listeners? Or
No. I appreciate you wanting to do this podcast, and hopefully our interview will have an impact on somebody. And that's what the hope is.
Going to inspire some people.
Yeah. And by the way, on a side note, for anybody that watches this prior to May 26th, we have the Advanced Medicine Conference coming up in Los Angeles.
Right, yeah.
So Jamie's going to be there, and Nicole's going to be there.
It's in Los Angeles.
So go to advancedmedicineconference.com and get your tickets there, and it's going to be a blast.
Yep.
There's going to be a lot of good people there. Dr. Lipton's going to be speaking there.
Dr. Bruce Lipton, yeah.
Yep. And Robert Scott Bell, my co-host from the radio show, he's going to be speaking. Ty Bollinger from The Truth About Cancer. Ty may not be there in person, but he's doing a recording, a lecture for us.
Yep.
And Nia Peoples, who's a celebrity, he's a great message. Del Bigtree from High Wire. He's the guy that produced the Vaxxed movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Del Bigtree's
nice.
Going to be there. And Dr. Bernhoff. And so there's going to be a bunch of, you know, of people with like-minded people. Yeah. So if you can get that, it'll be a great time. So.
See if we can get a few from New Zealand to travel over. So
excellent.
Yeah. No. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely.